Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
Le palier d'alerte de votre région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de familles dans les résidences et cours privés sont interdits. Les déplacements entre régions sont à éviter et les déplacements vers les zones jaunes sont interdits. De plus, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les mesures en place. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's Spoken Word Coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's Collective Management Committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
A 972 magazine is an independent media outlet founded exactly a decade ago by these ladies and gentlemen before you today. We focus on reporting and analysis primarily on Israel-Palestine, but also write quite a bit about the wider Middle East, about the United States, and other political, social, economic justice issues all around the world. It has been a decade of 972, and how we've seen, and we really want to reflect on and discuss what has been happening over the past 10 years in Israel-Palestine, in the situation of progressive journalism, and in the political and social situation around Israel-Palestine. Just yesterday, we saw an agreement signed between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain at the White House, which is arguably a very surprising and not surprising development. This webinar here is really an opportunity to also discuss how did we get to this situation? How has the work of our founders and of the magazine been very much at the forefront of that? What can we expect in the time to come, both in the public discourse and political developments? So this is really a perfect space to kind of take stock of where we are and where we'll be heading to, in the future. And so I will briefly introduce our guests today. First off, we have Dalia Shenglin, who is a leading international public opinion analyst and strategic consultant who specializes in progressive causes, political and social campaigns in over a dozen countries. We also have Noam Shezaf. He is an Israeli journalist and documentarist. He was the first editor and executive director of 972 and is currently working on several documentary projects. We also have Lisa Goldman. She's joining us from Montreal, where she writes, edits, and teaches journalism. She started out on the Haaretz news desk and became a blogger and freelance reporter. We also have Ami Kaufman, who is the host of the new podcast, Otherwise Occupied. We encourage you to follow that. He's a former news anchor and host of the political talk show, The Spin Room, on i24 News. And last but certainly not least, we have Dimi Ryder, who is an Israeli journalist currently serving as a senior editor at Newsweek. He is a co-founder of 972, of course, and has written for The New York Times, New York Review of Books, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, well done, Dimi, Haaretz, Jerusalem Post, and many others. Really glad to have all of you. Really excited to bring you all together a decade after you founded this site. And so let's kind of dive in immediately. I would love for you all to kind of describe to us the scenes and the situations that led you all to create 972. What was the local international media environment like? How did you all come across each other? What made you feel that there was a need to create this site?
So actually, it was Noam's idea. We were all of us had our own individual blogs at the time. Things were changing quite rapidly at the time in Israel-Palestine on the ground, but it seemed that the mainstream Israeli media weren't really reflecting what we saw. And Noam, I think you at the time had just come back from covering the 2008 election, and you noticed that it's strange to say it now, but the digital-only media, blog-style things were very new. and I think Noam had this idea that we should sort of aggregate all of our individual blogs, and we'd met through blogging. Well, some of us already knew one another in real life, but the blogging experience really brought us together. And so Noam sort of approached all of us to establish a single platform and write together on that platform. And I think we were all super intrigued and very, very motivated, because there was a sense of urgency that, you know, developments were affecting our affecting everything about our lives, and that there needed to be a more accurate sort of accounting and reporting of what was going on the ground. And it basically started in Noam's living room. And we sat around in cafes blogging from our laptops, and we sat on the floor in his living room and had our staff meetings. And so it went. I think that's basically all I have to say for now.
So from the perspective of this same living room, I think that on the substantial level, it was a moment that several things combined for us. First of all, it was the rise of blogging and citizen journalism, and you had the opportunity to do things that you couldn't do before, like you, with a phone or a mobile, you could cover a protest as a citizen journalist. That was something that wasn't available 5 or 6 years ago, so people like us started doing that. I think politically, it also has to do with a moment within the popular struggle. In several Palestinian villages and in several Jerusalem neighborhoods. And for me, at least, and some other of the bloggers, I know we attended several of the protests in Sheikh Jarrah, in Bilin, in Abi Salah. We met some of the groups that work there, Tayush, Anarchists Against the Walls. Some of them cooperated with us. And I think for us, at least for me personally, this was a kind of transformative moment in the way I understood the conflict and how to cover it, not within a framework of two states, two entities, diplomacy and all that, but from the perspective on the ground. And I specifically remember the protest in which Jawar Abu Rahma died from tear gas. And there were no film crews there because the IDF blocked the way to Bilin. But there were four or five 972 bloggers over there. And there was a big controversy later about what caused her death. And I think the fact that we were there And we were quoted, and we brought our perspective to the site, kind of reflected the new role we thought we might have in this conversation. So for me, that was a very big moment, right, as we get started.
Yeah, I think just to throw in, I think there were a couple of other kind of like elements that we engaged with. One was that the conversation happening in Israel-Palestine was much more nuanced and intricate than what was given platform in a lot of mainstream media. Like in a lot of the outlets covering it at the time, it was kind of like peace, yes or no, yet another flare up in Gaza. Who's going to win the election in Israel-Palestine, and Israel, sorry, Israel-Palestine elections, I wish. And kind of like all the incremental changes and some big changes as well, we're not really getting the time and attention they deserved. And then there are many, many voices from around the world, especially from the United States, weighing in on the politics and the conflict. Everyone has an opinion on Israel-Palestine, but very little reporting and conversation happening from people on the ground. And we wanted to try and balance that out.
Yeah, I was back then blogging on my own blog called Half and Half. And I noticed that I was doing a lot of like daddy blogging and stuff like that. But the more I got political, I noticed the more, you know, hits I was getting, the more popular I was getting, the more reactions I was getting. And that was, you know, the beginning of blogging. I guess when blogging was kind of like what podcasting is today, everybody there then wanted to have a blog. And it was also, if I remember correctly, these were like the early days of Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is also, you know, 10 years on, Twitter is something that I still just can't get a hold of. But it was, you asked Amjad about what the media scene was. I think we should also, zoom out a little as well, because these were the days of, it was post Ariel Sharon, it was post Olmert, it was the beginning of the Netanyahu era, when things just seemed to be going even more right all the time. The Yisrael Hayom newspaper was slowly making a change. I think Yisrael Hayom came out in 2007, so it was already about like 2 or 3 years old by the time we started, and it was, it eventually became the most widely circulated newspaper that here in the country. And also something that I think people should pay attention to back in that era is also the financial media scene that was also making a change in the country. Up until then, we only had one, financial daily called Globes. And eventually two other papers, the Marca and Kalkalist, came in, and Israelis became a lot more understanding of what, interest groups there are here in Israel. They understood more about budgets, about where money goes, how much money goes to the military. It was also an impetus, for, I think, what happened in 2011 and the social justice protests, which, of course, were, influenced by what happened in New York and in Madrid that year, the same year. But they also took, they were very, it was a very important time for media.
Maybe I'll give a quick background of my own, because I think I come from a slightly different background from other people. Pretty much from the time I moved to Israel, at the time we called it Israel, now I think of it as Israel-Palestine, that was 1997. From then until we started 972, I was busy losing elections. Well, we won one election, 1999, but things didn't work out that well. Ever since then, I've been losing elections. So I turned to academia somewhere in the middle of the decade, and I thought, okay, I'm going to take all this fascinating knowledge I have of the Israeli public and how politics works here, and I'm going to, spin it into gold through academia. But that was taking too long, and I saw the situation getting, to my mind, worse and worse. And then I think that I thought, okay, if I explain to Israelis who they are by analyzing the Israeli public publicly, that will help. So I had a column I was writing on Israeli public opinion at the Jerusalem Report, which was very analytic, but things just kept getting worse. And all the things that we sort of thought in the previous decade that we were going to be moving towards just kept rolling back. And I think that the real catalyst, so I should say that throughout those years of the Intifada and then the post-disengagement, when the whole idea of negotiations became increasingly remote, the two-state solution began to, I think, be exposed for all of its flaws. And then, just when we thought it couldn't get worse, Netanyahu won the elections. But even before that, Cass led. I think we haven't really talked about that, but I remember Cass led the first war with Gaza, with Hamas, as being the real, moment when all of those frustrations for a decade spilled out. And I thought, I can't wait for academia. I can't just analyze and analyze and analyze. I have things to say. if I give all my wisdom to the politicians the way I've been doing up until now, they will never do what I want them to do. They're a failure. And they will never implement the things that they say they will implement. And I can't just analyze anymore. And I felt like this huge scream kind of bursting out. And so it was around then that I met the other group here. I think we didn't really know each other before because I was in my sort of political world. But once we started 972, I suddenly realized just how much I had been waiting to say. And apparently how much people had been waiting to hear it. Not just me, of course, but right away we had, you know, hundreds of people on each article. And there was sort of a thirst to hear it and a hunger to say it. And so I think we were at an auspicious moment.
So to build off of this, actually, and Dalia, like you're finishing this point, like the need to kind of say things in a certain way, I'm curious how you also navigated a 972's kind of hybridity as both this professional journalistic outlet with the skills that you all brought to it, and at the same time be a kind of almost like unapologetically activist group based on your work on the ground with your connection to the activists, the politics that you were trying to address. What led you to that kind of choice that, you know, the non-typical, you know, that it wasn't just about objectivity, that subjectivity was important? How did you balance that kind of journalistic and activist role in the early years and in the years after?
For me, first of all, I co-sign everything that my colleagues just said. It was an enormous relief for me. I'd been reporting in Gaza through the months before and during the disengagement in 2005. I'd been on the ground at the grassroots demonstrations, the protests in the villages in West Bank Palestine. And I felt an enormous cognitive gulf, you know, when I'd come back to Tel Aviv after a day of reporting. And, you know, it's 45 minutes away and it's a different world. And I'd come back to Tel Aviv having had some, you know, seen some pretty horrific things often, and life was just, you know, sidewalk cafes and lovely liberal friends who had absolutely no idea what I was talking about. So when we all joined together and we were so committed to reporting what was really going on and what was not being reported by the Israeli media, let alone the international media, I felt you know, much less alone in the world, and that was super important to me. And also, you know, just to continue on with what Dalia said about, you know, the feeling, the sense of urgency to tell the story of what was going on. I mean, that was a huge motivator for me. You know, it felt all very, very immediate. And this idea of being objective, you know, I gradually let go of that. I don't strive so much for objectivity as for accuracy. Everybody has a point of view. You know, I can take, you know, when I teach journalism, I often take a single story and show how it's reported in five different media outlets that have different editorial agendas or points of view, you know. And so that's really one of the skills that I acquired as a reporter for 972. And as a team, you know, we really helped each other because, you know, some of us had stronger journalism backgrounds than others. And Noam, for example, and Ami, for example, have, you know, very, very strong journalism backgrounds. So it was really helpful to me to be both on the ground with them and discussing with them how to word the reports. And when we saw, as Noam mentioned, in Bilin on the evening of December 31st, 2009, I think it was 2009 or 2010, you know, when Jawahar Abu Rahma was asphyxiated by tear gas clouds, you know, and we were the only media outlet to publish that story. And we were eyewitnesses and we had photographs and we had, you know, we had evidence. And we changed the news cycle. We forced the army to acknowledge that it had been lying when it denied that they had been using unusually large amounts of tear gas. And so that for me, after that experience, I didn't have any more patience for the on the one hand, on the other hand kind of approach toward journalism.
I think for me, it's been a question, not exactly of objectivity, because we all know why we came to this. So I don't think we ever pretended to be, you know, some really, you know, like a news agency level of objectivity. To my mind, the tension that we've sometimes faced or the dilemma that we've faced has been between the three categories of opinion, analysis, and reporting. And you know, from the earliest days, I think that we have been, you know, braiding those three. Do we separate them out? Do we braid them together? You know, do we open a story with some of the factual newsy observations, you know, the five W's, and then move into our opinion? Or is it an, you know, how do we work those together? And I think that for me, on the one hand, there's nothing like seeing, you know, I think that being a public opinion researcher is really not that different in a way. You really want to just get inside people's heads, talk to them, figure out, you know, who people are. And the only way to do that is by observing. So I like, you know, I think that we have always had an on the ground aspect of it, a field observation aspect. But of course, where we really excelled in the beginning was in saying stuff openly. That's the our opinion and analysis that was not getting said. And so I think the dilemma has been much more about, you know, to what extent should those be combined in a single article? To what extent should they be basically separate? To what extent do we draw on other news agencies for the facts of the matter? And, you know, offer new perspectives. I think ultimately my choice has been context specific. There's times when I feel like we have perspectives that are not getting said. Let's get them out there. Let's get the analysis and opinion out there. There's times when I feel like there are stories that we know are happening that nobody else is covering and we need to report on them. And there's times in my professional world where I say, you know, I don't feel like making an argument right now, tired of arguing, but I can kill them with facts. I mean, not kill them, you know, I'm against violence in general, but there are lots of factual perspectives that simply are being told as half truths. And sometimes I just feel motivated to take that end of it. I don't think it's an either or. I think people can choose different ones that are either, again, context specific or personal motivation specific.
So I actually want to ask you as well, you know, taking the big picture of the past decade, I'm curious what you've seen to be almost like especially significant changes, either positive or negative, or significant shifts of some kind in the politics here in Israel-Palestine or in the wider globe. The potential significant changes in the media that you've seen, whether media in Israel-Palestine itself or even in the United States or internationally. What about like social movements, even like things like the Israeli left? You know, what for you have been, if you can give like one example of one of these kind of significant things that you've seen based on, you know, the factors that brought you all to create it a decade ago, and what you've seen as some of the most defining moments, or at least one defining moment, that has also kind of reshifted also the purpose of 972 and where 972 is within that scene. Maybe we can start with Dimi, if you'd like to go ahead.
I mean, I'd be hard pressed to pick just one thing. I think there are a lot of processes that are happening in parallel. Some of them are complementary, some of them are clashing. But just off the top of my head, I think several assumptions that we all had maybe 10 years ago are certainly that were propagated by kind of like the international community and various stakeholders were proved to be wrong. Like, for instance, the notion that the occupation is unsustainable and that the world will eventually pressure Israel into dismantling. And that's definitely not happening, and it's not happening in the foreseeable future. The notion that, as Tony Judd put it, Israel as an ethnic nation state is an anachronism. If anything, we're seeing more and more previously Western previously democratic state kind of like flirting with the same kind of ethnic nationalism, often ethnic nationalists using Israel as an excuse for what they're suggesting for their own countries. At the same time, I think that the kind of like the dying down of the Second Intifada and the normalization of the status quo has introduced some very fluid processes, almost wild cards, that we're still to see how they're going to play out and which is going to triumph. One, I think, is that even as fewer Israelis now than did before the Oslo process have ever met a Palestinian, whenever I visit Israel, I'm struck by how much more Arabic there is in the public sphere, on kind of like on public transport, on signs, in popular media, in a kind of like less direct way, Arabic Jewish Mizrahi music has been taking over more and more airwaves. So it's kind of like it's a less, Israel right now is less white in the best sense of it than I remember it. And it's less secular. Settlers were mostly talked about in the years before 2010 are now active and upfront players in politics, culture, and so on. the whole kind of like premise of the Oslo years of like Israel is overall just like, you know, it's fine. It just needs to fix its occupation problem. And then we can put it over there and put it behind the wall and do something about the settlements. All that is gone and everything is bleeding into everything else. That can lead in the long run to some kind of like a more optimal democratic space, or it can lead to a new clash. And I think right now it's very much on knife edge where it's going to go.
Ami, would you like to come?
Yeah, I mean, if I choose, like Dimi, it's hard to choose just a few, but like if I choose a negative one, I think it's important to remember that like all we've known as a collective, you know, known as a collective in these past 10 years is Netanyahu. He's been here for the whole time, basically. His grip on power, his war on the justice system, his lies, his corruption, that's basically, you know, all that we've known for the last 10 years. I mean, I guess on the positive side, I would think about, it depends on who you ask for, if you ask me, is the death of the Zionist left, albeit, you know, it's slowly, but it's a necessity. And hopefully what eventually needs to happen.
He takes personal credit for that.
Thank you very much, Talia. What I think, though, what eventually needs to happen, what I'm hoping for is for the dichotomy, you know, to change, that not, you know, who is left and who is right, but who is not a Zionist and who is for ethnic supremacy and who is not. That's what the discussion I'm hoping is going towards. If I had another few quickly, I think the death of the two-state solution, which Dalia kind of mentioned before. And if I also say what I'm hoping for, I'm hoping people stop talking about it. I think there's nothing more misleading and even cruel than wasting the time of Palestinians and Israelis on something that doesn't exist. It's a weight holding us back from moving the discussion forward. One thing that I also have noticed, you know, over the years, as an editor who pays attention to words in texts, the use of the A word by Israeli politicians as well, apartheid. The fact that we're having this argument is a huge step forward. I think all of us can see a difference, a major difference between what was happening, excuse me, in 2010 to how many times or how often we see this word in 2020.
I actually want to jump in on this with a follow-up question. Speaking precisely on these changes and the way that we're trying to bring these kind of radical messaging, I have a question, especially for me now, also as a Palestinian editor at 972 and a longtime member of the collective. And I guess the question I had for all of you is, for a long time and still to this day, there's a strong perception of 972 as inherently an Israeli organization. An Israeli outlet and collective primarily made up of Jewish Israelis. And so I'm curious how you grappled with the questions, especially of how Palestinians viewed 972 from its early years to where it is today. How did you face the issue of the diversity or lack of diversity for that matter during the early years of the collective? How have you seen that been changing? You know, how did the content and your production, your connections, like how was that, how did you guys work through that? Because it's things that we're also continuing to work on today in terms of trying to increase Palestinian representation and voices and centering them in a way that that at the time wasn't able to be done or so on and so forth. Like, I'm curious how you've been navigating also your connection vis-a-vis Palestinians and their participation in this project.
Not just Palestinians, but also Arabs outside of Israel, Palestine. So when we first launched, you know, we were just a bunch of middle class, overly educated, nerdy Ashkenazi bloggers living in Tel Aviv, and acutely conscious of that, you know. But there is such a taboo on what's called normalization that for us in our nascent stage, all of us Jewish, with the exception of Aziz Abu Sara, who was peripherally involved in the beginning, to try to reach out to Palestinian contributors was almost impossible. The rejection was very, very strong. We were an untested product. We hadn't yet we hadn't yet in a convincing way established ourselves as a media outlet with a commitment to certain ideas. So up front to say, hey, we're a bunch of Jewish Israelis and we'd like you, a Palestinian from the West Bank or Gaza or abroad without citizenship or rights to write for us, they'd be like, you know, no. And I remember also there were actual tactical problems besides the ideological issue. There were actual tangible problems with the Journalists Guild in Ramallah telling, you know, Palestinian journalists that they would be censored if they contributed to an Israeli publication. So for me, two things make me very happy. One is, you know, I have a lot of friends, writers, analysts, journalists around the Arab Middle East and the Maghreb, and they all read 972 magazine and really appreciate it now. And one actually said, please allow me the honor of writing for you. So that to me is an absolutely, that's superb. And you, Amjad and Henriette, and the fact that, you know, we have, you know, I feel like, you know, this sort of the torch has been passed to a new generation. And this makes me extremely happy to see that we have Palestinians from the occupied territory, from Palestine, from Gaza, from the West Bank, from inside of Israel, from abroad, writing for 972 and being proud of that. And, you know, I see it as an alliance now. I don't see it as a Jewish-Israeli publication anymore. I mean, how it's perceived by others, you know, look, I wouldn't walk around Cairo today and say, hi, I'm from 972 magazine, can I interview you? It's still not possible. But I would approach an Egyptian journalist and say, hey, would you write for 972 magazine? You know, he or she might say under a pseudonym, but they would write for us. Whereas before they would have said, no, I wouldn't write for an Israeli publication because it goes against my my views, my worldview. Now that's no longer the case. They appreciate what we're doing and they read us and value us. And that for me is like all of my hopes and dreams come true. Well, it's most.
If I can jump in, I think that another factor early on is that 2010 we were kind of like fresh out of the twin plagues of Oslo and the Second Intifada, none of which enhanced any faith that any Palestinians should have really in any Israeli peacenik. And, you know, we were just another bunch of like well-intentioned, supposedly well-intentioned people from Tel Aviv. And we were also, by trying to make it a binational space, we were challenging a notion that has not yet been put to rest of a two-state solution of a strong national autonomy that I think anti-normalization, at least in some ways, was meant to start building the foundations for. So kind of like, you know, you're trying to do that thing and you have a bunch of Israelis coming and wanting to join and you just say, hold on a second, we're building a community here. But I'm also kind of like, however we felt about it, I think it's also, I would be, not to put the Amjad on the spot, but would be very curious to hear from you, how do you feel right now as a Palestinian activist and journalist writing from 972 and editing, and would you have done so 10 years ago?
I guess to maybe briefly answer that, I joined the collective, and even this week, for example, I issued out a newsletter on behalf of 972, you know. When I joined the collective, started writing in 2013, you know, I was one of the few Palestinians who were there. But there was a reason why I was attracted to this collective. And the word I used in my newsletter was versatility. That even though, you know, I think all of us have very different opinions in politics in different respects, I think there was an understanding in the space that we were all going through a transformation. We were all going through our developments and changes. And that there was, and the mission that you guys are articulating, the goal was to make it a genuinely shared site. And it was to, you know, take it from a place where I think the site, you know, had great strategic value at the time and wanted to be where it is today. And we still have a long way to go and a lot to work, but that versatility and that openness to say, how do we gradually change that? And it's one of the few places that I've seen has really willingly grown in that respect. And that's credit again to the values of the collective and with its ups and downs and its challenges and obstacles. But that for me was always a big drawing factor. And that's why I've been this long time member.
Could I just add one quick thing? Just really quickly. I mean, if I'm really talking personally about myself, when this thing started in 2009 and 2010, and thinking about why didn't we have, you know, Palestinians joining us back then, I think that, you know, personally, I was very much a product of Israeli policies, of the segregation, of, you know, never learning Arabic in school. I had 1 year of Arabic in school, and I was very young. It was in Yesodi, a grade school. It was never mandatory to learn Arabic. There were no Arabs in my school or in my high school. And I was in, I was living in the city of coexistence, okay, Haifa, but I didn't know any Arabs. And when 972 started, I barely knew any, and I didn't really have a discussion with many. So, and I'm not trying to be, you know, to make excuses, but I think it's also a product of what this country was and what this country produced.
How has 972 actually changed? I mean, has 972 changed anything about your own personal politics or your views? Were there stories, interactions, encounters, developments over the years that you feel that the site has actually impacted you in some personal way?
I mean, I just have a lot to say on that, because I think that I'm going to go back to the beginning and maybe surprise a few of my colleagues here. But, you know, I was working for very mainstream parties in all the previous years, and usually Labor, Labor Party, and a little bit with Meretz. And I always felt like there was something missing. And then we found, when we started 972, it's not just that I had all this pent up stuff that I wanted to say, it's that I felt like I was home. And I realized that it was a legitimization of more radical voices. It was saying, I am not restrained anymore. It's not just that I've been building up things, accumulating things. It's the kind of things that we need to say. And we needed a, I feel like we needed a more radical tone. I felt like politically, everybody was trying to sound acceptable. I think that's still a problem of the Israeli left. I think that's, or the Zionist left, I should say. I think that's why they have failed, because they're too busy trying to pander and sound serious by sounding like a white security guy. Sorry to be blunt. And I think that when we broke out of that and said, you know, it's legitimate to have radical things to say, that meant we're not going to take it. We're not going to take those dictates anymore. We don't believe in them. They have failed us. Like Ami said, they produced a sort of mutant society of people who don't know the people next door or speak their language, where people who live next door speak a language that is incomprehensible in the public space because it's not on the signs. So I think that we basically said we reject all that. It's okay to have a more radical critique. And that did feel liberating for me. And I think that that allowed us to have the versatility, or develop the versatility that you spoke about in the beginning, and, you know, touch on a wide range of subjects, which is great for me because I'm frankly ADD. I also think that as much as I thought I knew about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and occupation, and boy, did I think I knew, because I was so into it even before I moved to the region. You know, I had dialogue groups with Palestinian students in Montreal at McGill. I, you know, thought I was a peacenik already by the time. Oh, my friends in the 1990s were wearing two states for two people t-shirts, and we thought we were very cool. So I thought I knew all about it. And then I worked in politics, so I really thought I knew everything. When I think that 972 allowed me a bit of a bit more of an opportunity to do some field reporting. And because we were sort of activist-y about it, we were going to places like Nabi Saleh and, you know, confronting the army and learning the technicalities of how the occupation works day to day up close. And we had the space to report those stories, not just the space, but that's what we were trying to do. We were able to get into the weeds. And I think that I was able to learn stuff that I feel badly for people who think that they care about this region and haven't read 972, just kidding, and haven't had that kind of education, because there's so much that is hidden. There's so much that is absolutely, you know, obfuscated by regular media, not conspiratorially. I don't really believe the media, you know, other media figures sit together and say, how do we cover stuff up? Although sometimes that happens too. But more often than not, it's just too complicated, too technical. The army and the government and, you know, the COGAD and the civil administration, they have an interest in making this stuff incomprehensible. Other media outlets are squeezed. Nobody has the capacity to do it. And it's frankly boring. And we said, we don't have the luxury of thinking that way. And so I learned a ton more about actually the mechanisms of how these things work. And that was really important to me. It certainly helped me explore more realistically my own political opinions. Like when I came to the realization that the old version of the two-state solution being negotiated back in, you know, the year 2000, 2001, and 2002, you know, just looking at the ground, it's not that hard to realize that it's not working. I think I had the sort of open-mindedness to say, A, let me call reality by its name, something that many actors shockingly still haven't done, which is, as which one of us said it, Ami, is actually damaging to people on the ground by people insisting on being locked into something that doesn't exist and is just distraction from actually moving ahead. And also gave me the freedom of mind to think creatively and attach my and find other people who have ideas about alternatives. And I want to remember to mention another early stage Palestinian who was involved, Omar Rahman, who, you know, we're in touch and we write stuff together. And I mean, it created contacts that helped me, it created contacts and communities that helped me open my mind and the sort of liberating sense that I don't need to be bound into finding favor in anybody's eyes. It's better to look at reality the way it is and come to the appropriate, you know, updates in my own thinking.
It's a bit of an overwhelming question. How did this project change you? Because at one point and for several years, it took such a big part of my life and brought me into all sorts of highs and lows that it's very difficult to narrow that. So, but I'm less involved. I'm on the board now and I write less. But then when I think about the years I was intensively involved in the project, I don't think so much about political education that happened to me on the site. And of course, I learned from all the interactions and the thing I covered. But I think about, you know, the kind of spaces that 972 moves in and the people I've met through the site. You know, there's the activist community on the ground, which sort of saw the site, and the Hebrew sister site later on, Mekomit, was sort of their hub to stories of, you know, protests in the West Bank, deportation, unrecognized villages, all that. So there's the activist community and there's the human rights community and people in B'Tselem or Breaking the Silence and the Association for Civil Rights that knew that when they came to 972, the platform is sort of a safe space that doesn't use, you know, gotcha attitude to them, but tries to understand their work and the value of it, but also the limits of it, which is something we learned to recognize. But I think that was something new to me. And of course, there's a huge community that contributed to the site and just people coming out of the closet and saying, you know, you have this funky, weird, radical project, but I'm a lawyer on publications and I'm not going to take money from you because I like what you're doing, which our attorney did for the first few years. And the people who contributed money to the site and the people who continue to do so, I still correspond with people who wrote comments to me in, I think, 2012. So I think, and I also think about, I think for me, you spoke about the contacts with people outside our circles, Palestinians. There have been many highs and lows in this process, and I think our struggle to make this an acceptable organization to people of different ethnicities and backgrounds, and our terrible mistakes along the way that we did, and some successes have been the internal process, I mean, much larger, much more educating process than the intellectual one. Like when you have a Palestinian colleague calling from you during Kasled and explaining to you why something has irritated him so much on the site that he's going to cut ties or vice versa. And some people we brought in, some people we didn't. I think I understand the value of diversification because it teaches you so much within the process, and I think that's something that I took from this time, from those years.
So we had a question here asking a little bit more kind of about how the work that you've done and how the site's work has sort of interacted with other journalists in North America and Europe and around the world.
For example, you know, what does it mean to see other journalists in other media outlets, including, I'll be curious, also mainstream outlets, and picking up on your work and citing the work that we've done, you know, following up on stories that have been broken. What are some examples or where you've seen also different interactions with, you know, with mainstream media and other journalists over the years?
I think, I mean, maybe speaking only for myself, but I think whenever that happens, that's, you know, that's one of the peak 972 experiences of bringing something from the ground and injecting into the mainstream conversation. Whether, you know, it's always nice when people give credit and link, but that's almost less, even less important than tweaking the conversation in some way. And I think that we all, 972 was born partly because the New York Times and other outlets started quoting our individual blogs, and Noam, I think, thought there was a potential for to concentrate that in one place. So that's kind of like, I don't think there is competitiveness there. I think there is a feeling that we're helping, speaking for myself.
I think it was huge. I mean, as much as we weren't working to try to make anybody like us, we loved it when people like us, naturally. I mean, of course, it also just leverage, right? You know, the same level of effort, but much more impact when major news outlets would, you know, link to our stuff, but then also ask individual writers to write what we're saying. I have to say that I think that, you know, comparing my column analyzing public opinion in the Jerusalem Report versus 972, I can tell you where there was a lot more media interest. The media interest was in, these are new voices. These are people saying stuff that we haven't heard before. And I think that we had a range of requests from other media outlets that have much, you know, had at the time and still have, frankly, much bigger audiences saying, oh, we're reading what you wrote on 972. Can you write a piece like that for us too? Because they heard it first on 972.
Yeah, I think just add something quickly. You know, I think we sort of liberated some of the foreign correspondents because, you know, Israel has a much vaunted free media scene, but the government press office does sort of hang over the heads of a lot of foreign correspondents, sort of letting them know that if they write things that are too critical, they could lose their permission to work as journalists in Israel. And in fact, that actually happened to one Dutch journalist who basically lost his visa for tweeting something from 972 from his personal Twitter account, which is unbelievable.
I think that was my article that got
your article. Oh my God, that was horrific. So the guy actually had to leave the country because he tweeted an article from your article from 972. So, you know, but that horrific incident aside, I think that a lot of reporters were always so afraid of the government press office and so afraid of the right-wing readers of their publications, emailing their editors with complaints about their coverage, that to be able to cite 972, an Israeli quote-unquote publication as their source, was quite liberating for them and of course very validating for me and I'm sure for the rest of us.
If I can actually, we have a question linking right off what Lisa was talking about. The question was regarding, you know, kind of like what have been some of the pressures that we've been facing that you faced, you know, in the early years up till this day, you know, from the Israeli government under Netanyahu, other efforts by right-wing groups or forces. How has that pressure played out on you and on the site, and how did you respond to that, or how has that developed over the years?
Well, I mean, I think we couldn't get press cards from the GPO forever. Yep. So for years, like, we couldn't. They were sort of persecuting us and you know, imposing all these arbitrary conditions, like you have to have 100,000 unique readers a month or some outrageous number like that. I'm probably getting it wrong, but something outrageous that even Haaretz couldn't aspire to. And also, you know, personally, and I think that's also been the case for some other contributors, because I was part of this collective and am part of this collective, I became PNG, persona non grata, with most Jewish organizations in the diaspora. So, you know, if I couldn't, for example, talk about my experiences as a journalist to a synagogue or a Jewish community center or a Jewish school. They simply wouldn't invite me because 972 is identified as a radical or a non-Zionist publication. We amplify the voices of Palestinians. And for all those reasons, I've been, you know, and I'm a nicely brought up middle-class Jewish girl from a traditional home. I can't get my foot in the door, even if I wanted to. I'm not saying this is my aspiration in life, but I've been told on several occasions that because of my affiliation with 972, I'm PMG in the Jewish communities abroad.
Ami, would you like to jump in?
Yeah, I've been, it's a touchy issue for me, I got to tell you that. Just like Lisa, I also know that I've been persona non grata in certain organizations. I know that I've been blocked, in interviews that I should have gotten, jobs that I wanted to apply for. I know that even jobs that I was holding, the 972 was somewhat of a scarlet letter that, harmed me in various places, even just, just in my last workplace, I was known as, you work in a TV station where you're supposed to interview right wingers and left wingers. And when people are looking, to book a left winger guest, they say, hey, go to Ami. He knows, it's because he worked for 972. He's the guy who's going to know all the left wingers. So not to mention, by the way, I think all of us can talk about, I got, when I was writing stuff in 972, I got death threats from people from all over the world. So that's something that should be taken very seriously because some of them were pretty scary. yeah, that's pretty much it.
I'm going to give totally opposite perspective. First of all, I felt a lot less persecuted when I stopped reading comments and, Facebook comments and stuff. So we don't see, I stopped seeing those kinds of nasty responses and death threats and the also the snarky, condescending, they don't know what they're talking about sort of thing. I stopped reading them. But I, from the opposite perspective, it's going to sound weird. First of all, I don't think I personally experienced some of the targeting that my colleagues have, which just means maybe I'm not radical enough. But I also think that because I have this other hat as an analyst who does public opinion research, I am invited into a lot of those kinds of forums that are more mainstream. And I always think, gee, they're going to find out that I was involved in 972 and they're not going to, it's going to change their view of me, or maybe they're going to disinvite me, or maybe they're going to stop inviting me, or maybe they didn't Google me enough, but as soon as they do, they'll figure it out. And I found that they, first of all, rarely do when I'm talking about mainstream, some of the pro-Israel Zionist communities. And then I also think it opens a tiny, tiny crack. And this is a major strategic question. It's not right. There are some colleagues and friends who probably wish I wouldn't speak, let's be honest, to AIPAC. But I think that all said and done, and I've thought a lot about this, and it's a dilemma, and I don't judge anybody else's choices. But I think that, when you have the opportunity to speak to people who are beyond, our supporters, which is what we did in the beginning, was galvanize our supporters. I think we should always take that opportunity.
I on a personal side, I have sort of a Dahlia experience that I walk around in the world with a feeling that everybody wants to know what I'm thinking. So I never felt censored or something, but I'm very privileged. Like, I'm a nice Jew from Tel Aviv, and 972, we had a woman reporting for us from Gaza during a military operation. Now that's persecution, risking her life both by writing to an Israeli publication and from the missiles and rockets of the IDF. So, and we couldn't pay her because you can't transfer money to Gaza because of Israeli and American policies. So that's scary shit for me. But on my other hat, as the executive director of 972, it's been extremely difficult. Lisa mentioned the press cards, but the simple issue of funding, we had German fund, the Heinrich Bell Stiftung being the first to fund us, and right after that you get letters from Bibi to the German Foreign Office asking them not to fund, so to speak, anti-Israeli sites, and then you have to answer the claims in those letters. And you have to answer all those claims that right-wing organizations are writing all sorts of funders and supporters for you. So I was always preoccupied with the struggles of the organization, which continue to this date, of against censorship and securing access to our Palestinian reporters when we want to do something, and keeping our fans on board and keeping our readers donating, because people were launching campaigns against us. And this is where I felt that I'm always struggling.
I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. I'm going to combine two of them together. I'm curious to hear your responses on this. So we have some questions kind of talking really about, like, how do you sort of essentially go past a certain echo chamber? You know, how do you break certain glass walls that are in between different audience members? Someone was even mentioning, for example, how even, for example, like liberal Zionists, like how do you even shift their attitudes? I imagine many of you have had experiences in the American Jewish community along with internationals and Palestinians as well. What kind of lessons have you taken in trying to sort of, you know, expand beyond these chambers? How do you try to convince and persuade? And some of you mentioned some of this. I'm curious what thoughts you might have on it.
I think the most remarkable work in that regard is being done by the current generation of 1972, and especially the people on Sicha Mekumet, on local call, the Hebrew version of the site. I don't think there's any website or outlet in Israel that's as diverse politically, as well as in terms of including people across all the many fractures between the river and the sea. Because, of course, both societies, and perhaps maybe especially the Israeli one, is deeply, deeply segregated along many more lines than just the Palestinian-Jewish divide. And I think the answer to that is not kind of like how do you try to influence people from such and such communities. It's the question of how do you bring these people into the room? How do you allow these voices to be heard, and what engagement happens there?
I mean, I would say that for me, one of the most, and this also goes back to earlier questions, one of the most powerful ancillary experiences I've had from being involved in 972 is learning to listen. And that sounded a bit precious as it came out, but I didn't mean it to be. One has a vision of how one wants this place to be. You know, and sometimes, you know, that can collide with your more universal values. So you have to choose. And that was, you know, that process of choosing, focusing on one set of values was, you know, definitely one of the most clarifying and edifying experiences of my life. You know, what do I care more about, that I have, you know, a country where I feel happy being a Jew, or having, a space where everyone's humanity is equally valued, and you know, is my commitment to human rights for everyone, or national rights for my tribe, and making that, you know, coming, being completely happy with that choice has been extremely clarifying for me, and very, very liberating, and it was really because I had constantly this ongoing conversation with colleagues, including the difficult conversations that Noam alluded to earlier. You know, there were some very, very painful conversations which sort of held up a mirror to me and my own, you know, blindnesses and prejudices. We all have them, and to accept them without self-loathing. And to change, you know, we can all change. So this has been for me, on a personal level, you know, I can save the world, I can save myself, and I can save both. But on a less glib note, that learning experience of just learning how to listen and set aside my prejudices, and integrate new ideas and new voices has been extremely important to me.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Sushi for breakfast. Come and see me popping.